At least I didn't do the CEDIA.
No.
I just realised last week, or last time, Neil, when I
looked at it. To the music of the village people.
Yeah, that's it. CEDIA.
You know what's happening next. You know what's happening next.
Hello and welcome to the AV Forum's Home AV podcast for Monday the 19th of August. And joining me on this edition is Dr. Julian Scott. Hi, Jules.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Phil.
We also have Neil Davidson from SNR Group or Surround Group. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Phil. Good use of the real name there.
Yeah. And Steve Carter from Cedia.
Hi, Phil.
At least I didn't do the CEDIA.
No.
I just realised last week... our last time, Neil, when I
looked to the back to it. The music of the village people.
Yeah, that's it. CEDS.
You know what's happening next. You know what's happening next.
You've put a thought in my mind for the next expo now. Cheers, Julian.
Oh, there we go. Apologies. I did that last time to Neil. I just did SRND and it's actually Surround Group. So there we go. I just wanted to correct that. But now we've got YMCA in our heads and can't get rid of it. So what are we talking about this week? We're talking about screening rooms, home cinemas, media rooms. We've discussed the audio side in quite some detail. So it's time to talk about video. So we're talking about video chain. We're talking about sources. We're talking about projectors and TVs and which is the best for you. That's what we're talking about today. Hopefully we'll come up with an answer or some answers for you because like audio, video is the same. There's no, there is black and white. It's called grayscale, but there's no black and white answers to what actually suits you and your environment. And again, it comes down to the environment. It comes down to the room. I know I keep banging on about this every podcast, but the room is the most important part of the puzzle. And we'll get into that and why that is the case very soon. If you want to watch the podcast, you can do that on our YouTube channel. It's not the main channel. It's actually our YouTube AV Forums podcast channel. So it is different. But if you subscribe to that channel, you'll never miss a podcast, basically. These podcasts are launched every Monday evening at 7 p.m. And you also have the audio only version on Spotify, iTunes and other podcast providers. If you enjoy our content, if you enjoy what we're talking about here, if you get a lot out of it and you think that you have friends or peers who would get the same out of it, or you're a member of a forum or Facebook group or whatever, and you think this information is good for those groups, then please do share it. Share it around on social. That would be appreciated if you did that. We want to try and get to as wide an audience as possible. Who are we? We're AV Forums. We've been around 20 odd years. Our goal is good information, to get you the best information so you can make informed decisions about your home cinema, home theatre, whatever it is that you're interested in, the hobby. We'll try and impart our knowledge to you. We've been around a long time. I'm Phil Hinton. I'm the editor. I've been around 20 years on this site. I'm ISF, PVA, THX certified. I do most of the videos and YouTube channel and all that kind of thing, as well as reviewing the latest TVs and some audio gear. And also with us today is Jules. Jules, he's changed his role a little bit. So Jules, introduce yourself and tell us what's new.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Just very recently, I have been employed by Habitech as cinema specialist. So, came completely out of the blue and really enjoying that. So I'm still doing some calibration work, but only to Habitech customers.
We'll get into Habitech and we'll get into what you're doing there and so on in future podcasts. There's lots to get through. But again, it's all on the subject that we're talking about here. We've also got Steve from Cedia. So who's Steve from Cedia? Tell us all about yourself, Steve.
Phil. Steve, Cedia, been with Cedia now just over 10 years this year. And my role is business development manager. So I go out, meet all our members across the country, whether they be the trade supply members like Neil type of or Habitech, and all those standard integrator members across the board.
Excellent. And we've got Neil. Neil, tell us all about Surround Group and what you do.
So Surround Group serves AV integrators across the world. Very exciting stuff. We're really specialising these days in DCI screening rooms, so quite topical for today's podcast. We do a few other bits and pieces of cool stuff as well, but you know, we like to focus on things that we think are cool and then hope that someone else agrees with us.
Okay, well, that's the panel today. Hopefully we can impart some knowledge to you. We can tell you a little bit about what to do if you've got a screening room, if you've got a home cinema, if you've got a media room, or even just a living room, and you want to get the best out of this hobby, whether it's audio, video, or both. Hopefully both, because I think it's 50-50 each side. I think most of the guys would agree with that. So what are we talking about today specifically? Well, displays, they vary. You have lots of choices. Back in the day, you really only had one choice, which was a projector. If you wanted to go really big screen, you wanted to go home cinema. TVs just didn't get to those kind of screen sizes. And back in the day when I started in this hobby, that was a CRT projector, which was like bolting a mini metro onto your ceiling. These things were huge. I remember, I think the last CRT projector I had was a Barco 808, so 8-inch CRT tubes basically, with lenses on the front of them, firing at a screen. You needed 45 minutes for it to warm up properly, and then you had to go in and check the convergence. And so it was usually about an hour and a half before you could actually sit down and watch a film, with all the setup and tinkering and everything that you needed back then. But things have changed since then. So we've got a plethora of devices that we can call upon. We've got ultra short throw projectors, which are new and upcoming, a big area of the market. We've got the traditional long throw projectors, everything from your BenQs and Epsons all the way up to Christies and Barcos and hundreds of thousands of pounds that you could be spending on that. You also have displays, and again, everything from 500 quid all the way up to 500,000 quid. It depends what you want and how deep your pockets are and what it is that you're actually going for and trying to achieve. So again, we come back to the main thing, which is the room. The room's the most important thing, and the room will also dictate, in a way, guys, the display that people are going to choose. So let's go to Neil first. Neil, when we look at the room, what are the first things that you're looking from a design aspect? What's the first things that you're looking at before you even come onto the display type?
Well, actually, for me, when we're doing a design of a cinema, it's actually the screen size is the one that we look at first of all. It's the first parameter, in fact, because once we know the screen size, everything else kind of just automatically falls off of that. Your viewing distances and all of the rest of the stuff. That's something that's been a discussion point for such a long time as resolutions have changed and all that type of stuff over the piece. Despite that, though, in fact, ergonomically, you find that the distance to the screen hasn't really changed. It's just that you can see it a little bit more clearly these days. So that's what we tend to look for first of all. Once we've kind of looked at that, you also, of course, have to verify that it can fit ergonomically into the space. We always talk about our own homes and stuff, guys, but that was one thing for me. When we did some work in our house, I actually flipped the TV onto a different wall, and that changed the game completely on how we could lay out the space within our room. Just hadn't thought about it when we bought the house, and after many years of living in it, we were able to change it around.
So, Steve, obviously, Neil's looking at screen size first of all, and that's something that it's going to dictate how the room is laid out. But one of the old adages, and I still think it's true today, it was ISF that always said contrast is king, and resolution was number three or number four on the list. So that's an important factor that we've got to think about. We want the best possible picture quality within the room that we have. So what should people be looking at these days when it comes to, display type and the room design?
Well, if you remember back in the day when we were looking at things like calibration and room designs and different cinemas that we used to get involved with, or media spaces, the technologies around in that was available in those days were a lot less powerful, a lot less bright. So things like projectors had to be in a very dark environment. LCD screens, once again, were restricted on sizes to get a decent level of performance. And so consumers would look at a smaller screen in a media room, and a bigger screen would be in a projector room or a dedicated cinema space. But we had to make them as dark as possible. Nowadays, though, with the light output of even a standard projector, it's phenomenal. And then you have OLED, and then we have other direct display or direct brightness displays that are available. So yes, we can now start looking at and hitting the contrast levels that we require in a specific environment.
And obviously, I mean, we keep talking about your black hole, Jules. We won't go there again this week, but things have changed as well in terms of brightness because we're now in high dynamic range is a thing. Contrast really is king now because we need that dynamic range to get the best out of the content. Now, luckily for us at the minute, Hollywood are kind of sticking around at 1,000 nits in terms of the envelope that they're working in. But Sony have released, new professional monitors that can go at 4,000 nits. The Dolby Pulsar, even though it was 1080, was doing 4,000 nits. And there's a big push for more nits. So again, contrast really is a really important thing when you're thinking about a display and the type of content you're going to be watching.
Yeah, and actually, to that point, I would say, Phil, that the increased brightness of projectors has made control of ambient light within the room even more important, because ANSI contrast is a measure of dark and bright on screen at the same time. So if you're pumping out a hell of a lot more lumens from your projector, it's going to get reflected around the room even more. If you're planning a dedicated cinema room, you really do need to think seriously about the decor. And obviously, you talk about black holes, and it's true. Black is the best. It's the most absorbent color. And a fabric wrap around your room is going to be even better than a paint, which is still slightly reflective. It's slightly less important, obviously, with a flat panel, because it's self an OLED self-emissive, and it will have a nowadays they've got very good filters on the front of those TVs as well. But you still have to think about decor in terms of your contrast. And a bright room is also going to pull you out of the movie. The decor, what's around you, what you're looking at, is going to have that exit door effect. So you still have to think, even though we've got brighter TVs, more capable projectors, you still have to very much think about what you're prepared to put up with in terms of your cinema design. Are you going for a dedicated cinema, or are you going for a more of a media room where there is necessarily some compromise?
Neil, you obviously design these spaces for a whole range of clients, not just uber expensive systems. You put in a whole range of different systems. What are the compromises or what are the solutions that you come up with when you're looking at the display, the contrast, the decor? Because at the end of the day, people don't want to sit in, unless it's a dedicated screening room, people don't want to sit in a dark room.
Well, I think you've said screening room, and we're going to discuss hopefully screening rooms, because we're trying to define screening rooms as a very specific thing these days. But if we just talk in general terms, I think this is something that we've touched on in earlier podcasts. I think that you've got to always understand that there is a balance between technical performance and aesthetic performance, and you must understand that one person's preference may be in a different direction to your preference. And so you've got to try and satisfy everybody when you do these designs. Now, one of the things I can remember doing when I was teaching the ISF training classes 8 bajillion million years ago is that you would talk about how your eye changes in sensitivity, and it's more sensitive to black and white levels as opposed to color and all that type of stuff. And these are all the tricks that you can use to build a room that is interesting aesthetically without necessarily being damaging from a performance perspective. However, there are always little things that catch you out. And I'll give you one that always catches us out on these projects is door handles. Door handles, Julian will have seen that, I'm sure, as well. If you have a nice chrome plated door handle and it catches the light, that can be an absolute killer. And we've seen that on lots of projects because people are very, particular about door handles, and they want something, that feels nice in the hand and all the rest of it. And that's something that it's not just the macro details that you've got to be aware of. In fact, those are often the easiest things to take care of. It's these little micro things. In a commercial cinema, it's always the exit sign. A lot of situations that we're involved with, though, there's got to be emergency lighting and stuff like that. Maybe there's a little green LED. A lot of the viewers of this podcast, I'm sure, will be familiar. They put an AVR at the front of the room, and the display on the front of the AVR. how many times do you see a company does it almost perfect and then they put like a bright green or a blue single LED, which is almost more annoying than having a display? So all of these very small things, it's often the micro issue as opposed to the macro issue that is the most distracting. And if you have gone to the extent where you're really trying to optimize contrast, what happens is a chemical change in your eye has to happen to really optimize the black level that you're seeing. In many cases, incidentally, it's better to keep the ambient light at a certain level. That's what bias lighting does to help that effect. But that's why those little tiny pinpricks of light can be so much more annoying than just a general ambience, because your eye is trying to do its chemical thing to maximize your contrast. Very interesting when you see these little problems popping up at the end of a project.
And I've run into those, and it's things that you just do not think of. And I'm sure there's viewers and listeners out there who've done the same thing. I've gone to the trouble of finding out the best wall color and the best way to try and kill as much light as possible in the room, black velvet on the screen wall, all that kind of thing. Make sure you've got a black edge to the image, enhance the contrast, and so on. And then I've hung movie posters with glass fronts in the room, thinking they look nice, and all it did was reflect the light around the room and absolutely kill the effect that I've gone to try and solve. The other one was a very, very nicely designed custom installation theatre where they put the rack at the back of the room with the AVR on the top of the rack, and the light from the AVR killed the contrast on the screen straight away. As soon as the lights went off, there was still this light coming off the screen, and it was the AVR sitting at the back of the room. So yeah, if you're going for absolute, then you really need to be thinking about these things. So let's break it down into rooms. Neil, you mentioned screen room, so let's get that out of the way first of all, because I think some listeners might, this might, terminology might be new to them, or they're thinking, well, screen room, surely that's just Hollywood where they look at dailies and that kind of thing, or at the end of a day shooting. But it's actually a specific thing now in the world of custom installation.
Yeah, so we're really trying to stress the difference between these spaces, right? So screening room, cinema, and media room has been three distinct things. So why bother to do something like that? Okay. If you look at the range of content that we've got available to us now, there's millions of great things. Gaming and all of those types of things come into that as well. And they are, if you're doing a room that's a more mixed use room, it might lean towards home cinema, but you might accept a few compromises to make the gaming experience better, for example. A screening room, on the other hand, for us is really a space that's designed for video. That's what we're very, very clear about. It's designed for reference quality video, and that kind of dictates the kit and the layout and all of those types of things. And they are quite distinct when you sit down and you look at all those technical things from a home cinema. So we're really trying to clarify for people who we're working with, is it really a screening room? Okay, because then we're not going to be so worried, for example, about 120 frames per second and all of that type of stuff. All the choices that we're going to be making are about optimizing the video quality. We're going to accept all the lag in the world, for example, if that makes the video quality better. A home cinema, it might be the same value as that screening room, but we're going to do things differently in the home cinema to optimize that experience. Now, one of the things specifically in the screening rooms that we work with these days is that we look for a thing called DCI compliance. So DCI is the content standard that's used in commercial cinemas. Okay. It's by far and away the highest possible format of content that you can get. It's what all the dailies that you've mentioned and everything are all in that format as they move around. What's cool is that that content is available now for a certain individual, of course. Now that has to be played on actually DCI certified hardware, and it's interesting for us because DCI certified hardware, it's a little bit like HDCP, but it goes way beyond that. It's got to deliver a certain contrast level. It's got to deliver a certain brightness. It's got to deliver a certain color response, etc. So in fact, it's very interesting when you look at that, because not only do you guarantee, access to very good content, you've actually got a very, very strict level of performance that you're going to be able to do, and you're not kind of course, you're still worried about specs, but it's not like consumer specs. Yeah, they've got to be tested to prove that they can meet those technical specs. So a screening room for us is really that very specific thing, distinct from a home cinema, which can still be amazing, don't get me wrong, but it's just a different set of priorities that someone might want to put into that.
And I'm fascinated by this because I've always heard that, if you were part of a certain group or you were part of Hollywood or you had some kind of connection that you could have day and date release in your home cinema, home environment. But it's interesting that this is now marketable. This is something that you can, and when you get to this level, we are talking about the high end, uber high end of what is capable and what you can get out there. So the figures that we're going to talk about to the common man are excessive, but there's different world that does exist out there, I find it fascinating that you can get this content in the home. Yeah, it's going to cost you a lot of money. Maybe you can touch on some of that, Neil, but the fact that you can, on the same day as it's hitting your multiplex, you can go and sit in a screening room and watch that same content in the same quality. And my understanding is that audio-wise as well, it's the full DCP package that you're getting at
Yeah,
home,
it's
the whole.
exactly the same package that we're talking about. So, I mean, look, you've highlighted a few things there, Phil, that are just important. So let's not pretend it's not for everyone. You're going to be round numbers about 100 grand for a DCI display, another 24 grand for the server that stores the content to give you access to this. These are not small numbers. The audio system could be 32 channels, it could be 50 channels. We were very lucky to do the 55 channel that I've mentioned previously, which was a full DCI system. Now, that used to be a thing people might have heard on the grapevine of this thing called the Bel Air circuit. Bel Air circuit is a real thing for the Hollywood people. There's a very nice chap in Pasadena, of all places, who manages that on behalf of the studios. And you've got to be very, very well connected in that whole production world to get it. It's not just like because you're rich, you can get it. You've got to be connected into that whole thing as well, because it's not meant to be an entertainment. It's meant to be an accommodation, basically, for people in the industry to get access to that. The general assumption being that, if you're Tom Cruise, you can hardly go to the local multiplex to watch a new film, and cheerlead for your best friends or anything like that. Now, there are many, many, many people in the world who are movie enthusiasts and have the financial wherewithal. They also would like to enjoy that type of stuff. And so we've been able to come up with a solution that's just a simple commercial transaction that allows them to get access to this content without having to be part of the Bel Air circuit. Now, there was a super cool post on LinkedIn by one of our dealers over in the US. His client was sitting in their cinema watching Deadpool and Wolverine. I mean, that's cool, isn't it? I don't care who you are, that's cool. That's what we all dream of, isn't it? That's not a home
Absolutely.
cinema, that's just a cinema. It happens to be in your house. That's what we all dream of, okay? And that's what having access to, you've said it there, the DCP, that's the packaged file that the DCI content comes in. A DCP isn't compressed in the same way as a streaming stream is. It uses JPEG 2000, which is all wavelet based and all very clever. So it's classed as uncompressed. The streaming rates are 250 megabit per second, 250 megabit per second, okay? It's not compressed down like YCBCR and all of that type of stuff either. It's full bandwidth color that you get. And for me, I have to tell you, that's what I notice. If you see a 2K DCP against anything else, let me tell you, the 2K DCP has a color depth that's just out of this world. The other thing is the audio. The audio is typically 2448 PCM audio. So again, look, it's uncompressed audio that you're getting. Now, obviously, anyone listening to this will have heard of Atmos, DTSX, AuroMax. These are actually commercial immersive audio formats. Now, When you get a DCP file, it actually has a separate secondary DCP of the object of the audio playback. So you have a second Ethernet stream from your projector that sends the audio down to a processor, a CP950, for example, that gets decoded, and you get basically however many channels of audio you've programmed into your processor. That expands that up. Again, it's uncompressed audio. These files are very, very large, I'm sure you can imagine, for these movie files. But dear me, you can notice it. You can really notice it. And if you want the best, well, for me, that's the best. There's just no two ways about it.
Yeah, I think we'd all sign up for that. If we hit the
You
numbers, it
you're
would be
building a
10.
room now, aren't you, Phil?
Yeah, it's not getting that.
A bit of Netflix for you then.
The thing is, that's all great, but you've got to have the space in you, haven't you? You've got to have the type of room to take advantage of that. You need a certain amount of space to take advantage of it.
Well, so here's where it's very interesting what's happening in the world. So up until very, very recently, DCI was exclusively the domain of projection systems. Okay. And in fact, there were only a very small number of companies, NEC, Barco, and Christie, because Sony had exited that market, who made DCI compliant projectors. Now, we've all spoken about HDCP and how annoying that is. A DCI compliant projector on the formatter board, which is the thing right where the DLP chip is, that's where the decoding of the movie file happens. It's not like something or anything. It's all done right inside the projector. The actual media player is embedded, like some sort of weird twin right inside the actual display itself, so that there's no chance, obviously, of it being copied or anything like that. And it's all digitally watermarked. If you film that thing, they know exactly what playing it was that thing came from. There's no chance taken, if we could say that, with that quality of content. But what's recently happened is that the DCI specification was updated, and it allowed LED walls, okay? So particularly micro LED, that's something that we are very much getting involved with at this minute in time also. We spoke about resolution already, so you saved me having that whole discussion. A 2K resolution micro LED wall is available, which is only the same size as a 90-inch TV. So that has in fact changed the game somewhat from, yeah, it used to be a room of, 10 meters by 7 meters was the minimum that you can do. Hey, now it's a 90-inch TV. Well, okay, that opens up a lot of opportunities, and if you look at London, for example, or New York, or a marine application, the floor space can be very, 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 very expensive. A square meter in London can be upwards of £40,000 in these houses. Well, that 90-inch LED wall, hey, that can go there very nicely. And there's plenty of scope to put a DCI system in there these days.
Okay, that's the Uber end. We're all salivating. We're all, yeah, we'd love to have that in the home, but it ain't going to happen for the vast majority of us. But for those who are connected or who, they are lucky enough to have these systems, then all the best, because I would sign up on the dotted line straight away if I could have that, and I think all of us here could. So let's start to move back to reality a little bit, and look at other rooms that we have available. So let's come to Jules. Jules, obviously Neil's dealing with the uber high end there. Let's talk about home cinema. What are the differences with home cinema? And I guess the main difference here is choice. We have a lot more choice. We're not, we don't have to hit a certain specification like DCI to be served the content. We have all the content we have there that we can subscribe to, that we can go out and buy physical media and so on. So it opens things up a bit more.
And also those words home cinema are very open to interpretation, because you see people on forums posting a picture of a 65-inch TV with a soundbar saying, "Look at my home cinema,"
But that's a home
and
cinema to them.
it is to them indeed. It's in the eye of the beholder, I'm sure. I'm just an old Fuddy-duddy, Phil. I think that if I'm going to say cinema, it has to be projection for me. And know that, I mean, we do in my habitat, we do the Samsung wall, so the micro LED walls that Neil's talking about, etc. I still love watching projection most of all. For me, that means cinema, scream cinema. That doesn't mean that flat panels, especially as they're getting bigger nowadays, don't necessarily qualify. The larger screens, we're going to see obviously a big challenge to projection, I think, from those those 100 inch plus TVs that are coming out. So yeah, for me home cinema for me is projection. I know other people will draw the line somewhere else, and they'll, as I say, flat panels are going to be coming more and more into this. And of course, your design, as we hinted at the very beginning, the design of your room is going to vary depending on whether you have a flat panel or whether you have a projection system as well. So it's going to be, I obviously, what Neil was talking about, a lot of these places are going to be designed from the ground up, to keep out unwanted noise, to things, noise within as well, like air conditioning systems, all that kind of stuff. You want this will all be really tightly done. Home cinema, often, very often, we're fitting retrospectively into a certain space, like a garage or an attic or something like that. And we can do great jobs with them. We can do fantastic experiences within those spaces. But it's obviously necessarily order of degrees cheaper in most cases than the kind of rooms that Neil's been sort of defining. And then at what point does home cinema move into media rooms? That's a very porous boundary. And I'm sure everyone has got a different opinion as to, what's a media room, what's a home cinema. So for myself, I think first of a well-built darkened black decor, dark decor at least, projection room for home cinema.
And I'm with you on that one. I think that was the goal for such a long time, was to have a room that we could dedicate. And we've already talked about, making sure that we cut down reflections, maximize contrast, and so on. And I have to say, not just because Steve's on the podcast, but I have a real passion for JVC image quality. Now, don't get me wrong. When I have to review things and all the rest of it, I can put that to one side and analytically assess other images out there. But for me, JVC just did something right. The DLA technology, that black level, the contrast that was available, and still, I switch on the N5 that I have here. It's still a bulb-based projector. You switch that on, and it's like, oh, actually, that looks amazing. It's not 1,000 nits. It's not. I'm not seeing that. Although JVC do a really, really good, HDR process. It's something about the reflective image, Steve. It makes it different from a direct view TV, and that's not putting anything onto a direct view TV being bad, because they're not. It's just, and a TV can look cinematic, but there's just something about that reflected image back, isn't there, Steve?
Now, I'm not being ageist here, right, considering our ages, I know we're all of a similar age that sat here on this podcast. And when you look at some of the stalwarts within our industry, we've all been brought up at the cinema actually watching the screen, not watching the second screen, but actually watching the screen. And we are lucky enough to see some of these amazing movies that are now sequeled and sequeled and sequeled and sequeled, but we were there when the first version of those movies were out. So for us, nostalgic wise, we always have, if we're going to have an entertainment space, it's got to be a projection system. And to be totally honest with you, Phil, I completely agree. I am a cinema buff. I will, 9 times out of 10, when I'm looking for the latest movie, try to find the biggest screen that I can find it on. When I want to see Dune, I saw that at BFI 70mm version, but that's my passion, that's my love. Because the newer generation that are coming through, as I say, are looking at the second screen, they will happily take a direct view. And I think this is where some of the challenges and some of the specifications, when you look at cinema room design has changed over the years, and it's now becoming, rather than it being a media room versus a cinema room, it's now an entertainment space, because the performance level from all these displays that we previously mentioned are at such a high point now. But more importantly, they'll also have maybe a pool table at the back of the room, or I know this is heresy to all of us sat on the call, sat on the podcast, but
cocktail bar.
You know, yeah, they'll have a cocktail bar, they'll have a pool table, they'll have some other multi-purpose or multi-use space. So hence why, you know, you've got various guidelines that are coming in now that are saying, you know, you can get the high performance from your audio, but also high performance from your video. And there'll be more guidelines to that end next year to build that back up, which Julie knows about. But the point I'm trying to say is, you know, for us, we look at, you know, the holy grail is the projection system, and to be able to sit there in your seat in an immersive environment, experiencing something that is completely enthralling. But we then have to also consider that, one, some people aren't interested in that option. Heresy, I know. but some people aren't considering that option, but they still want the performance level to a degree. So yeah. Those are the options that are available.
And Neil, I'm making assumptions here, but I would imagine that, you know, you're not just dealing with a client at the end of the day either. With a lot of these jobs, you're dealing with the architects.
I never deal with the client. I always have to deal with everyone else. Someone right. else's job to deal with the client.
Yeah. So you have to deal with the architects. You have to deal with everybody else that has an input into that space. And that doesn't necessarily mean the best in terms of contract. Certainly in the past, I would imagine that some of those conversations would be pretty fraught, because, you know, some of the decisions made to put certain decor in would murder the image quality.
Interior designers, Neil.
I got on very well in the main with interior designers. It's not something that, honestly, it's really not something that we've ever struggled with. And I always hear all the jokes when we're out and about. I tell you the thing that, as M&E, any M&Es watching here, please do your job properly, because you mainly suck. That's my experience. Not all M&Es, I'm sure, do suck, but my experience of those involved in cinema design is that they suck. Mm. You have a lot of stakeholders in these projects. That's probably a really, really good way of putting it. There are a lot of stakeholders, and everyone, I think you've got to appreciate that everyone's job is different. The M&E who I slandered there, for example, his job is to make sure there's fresh air and all that type of stuff, and the air is at the right temperature in the room. The interior designer, it's her job to, or his job, to make sure that the room looks as beautiful to the client's tastes, remember, as possible. You know, and we've all got to kind of live within that little that little sphere.
Now, the point I was going to make, though, Neil, is that's how it was in the past. Is display technology now that you've got micro LED walls, you've got these new projectors now where they're pumping out a lot more lumens, they can do a really good HDR performance from them. It has that changed that dynamic in any way? Because you now technically you can still do that within something that's not a black hole.
Well, I come back to where we started this discussion, right? All of that tech is cool. But none of that, for me, fundamentally changed the way that we design these rooms. So, in fact, those arguments really don't change. You can deliver a better level of performance, perhaps accepting a different type of compromise. That's why, for example, if we're involved in the screening room, as I defined it before, we'll fight tooth and claw for optimal performance, because that's what that space is. If it's a home cinema and the client wants to have some cool LEDs, well, no one more happy than me to provide all of those types of things, because we know that that can add such a lot to the overall experience. Now, perhaps that's at the expense of contrast or something like that, but that's not necessarily what adds up to the sum total of the overall experience. And we're always happy to make those sort of compromises. Now, there's one thing that I want to raise for all the guys on the call as well. There's a single company who unwittingly has helped all of us in home cinema, and that's Microsoft. And guys, anyone want to guess what Microsoft did to help us with our home cinema solutions? It's the reference Teams room. Okay. So a reference Teams room for a boring office to have a boring Zoom call. Teams call, of course, is based around a wide aspect display. The dreaded 21:9 ratio, which I can never get my head around. And all of a sudden, what that has done is, like, a lot of the problem that you've got with a flat panel is a flat panel 16:9, okay? And it's always 16:9. Projection, you can do all types of cool stuff with aspect ratios. But now, because of Teams rooms, there's loads of cool new stuff that's coming out that's got a 21:9 aspect ratio. Flat panels, ultra short throw projectors, etc. So all of a sudden, for me, the biggest change is not so much about the contrast or the color, because, you know, they're all important, but technology moves. It's the fact that you can deliver an element of cinematic, which is the aspect ratio, for me, is the thing. You see that wide aspect. That's always been my thing. That's where projection has always been. A different experience altogether. Now you can do that with a flat panel. Now you can do that with an ultra short throw projector, and that was never possible previously. And we've got Microsoft and Teams reference rooms to thank for that. In fact, there's a whole unbelievable amount of documents. RP22 could learn quite a bit from the thickness of the document for designing reference Teams rooms. And that is opening up a lot more. So, for example, at an upcoming EI Live show, which is next month, we're going to be showing a 21:9, 105-inch flat panel. Okay, that flat panel was not made for home cinema. I wish I could say that it was. It was made for Teams rooms. But guess what? Now you can blend in a so-called media room. Yeah, the lights are on, but a flat panel performance, but it's still cinematic. What is it? Well, it's an experience that wasn't actually possible before, that perhaps, as Steve says, yeah, we're all of an age where we're not used to that second screen, but that second screen's got the money now.
It
flips on its
head again what you can do with these types of things. So
yeah. And of course, the beauty of micro LED, Neil, and it's something that blew me away. As soon as I saw that technology, it caught my imagination, is the fact that the panels, and you can have any aspect ratio you like. And that, to me, just, you know, the first thing I thought was, oh, I could have a 2:30 or 9:1 ratio screen with that HDR performance, with that, you know, OLED black level, but with the LCD brightness, with the dynamic range and the cinematic aspect ratio. And you're right. I mean, we're all fuddy-duddies, as Joel said, that we all love our projection and all the rest of it. But actually, looking at where we could be going with displays and how quickly those large screens are falling in price as well, as a consumer, it's very, very tempting where we're going. And then you're all going to hate me for this, and I hate myself for saying it as well, but high frame rate is going to be a thing. Steve mentioned the next generations coming through. Well, these are generations that have played 120 frames per second gaming. They're used to that fluid movement. They're used to that, and 24 frames looks odd to them. Whereas high frame rate looks really odd to us, because we've been brought up on 23.98 frames per second content, and that's what we love. I mean, as soon as you switch any interpolation on a display, I can see it straight away. Lots of people can't, because they've been brought up on a different way. So where are we going in the future? I'm going to come to Jules first, because he's a stickler in the mud. But Jules, where are we going in the future?
I am a stickler, and I hope films will stay at 24. But there's definitely a need and for higher frame rates. We've seen it in gaming, but for sports broadcasting, for instance, wouldn't it be cool to see the Olympics right now in a higher frame rate? I was looking at this myself. I think it was the hammer throwing. And when the hammer is first released from the hand of the thrower, it does a little stutter and a judder, and then it smooths out. And I've seen that on football and stuff like that. So definitely, for certain genres, I think a higher frame rate is coming, and it's a thing. Interestingly, also, I noticed this during the Euros, that the BBC HDR broadcast was actually dropped down to 1080.
There's no 4K feed from the Euros.
Exactly. Yeah. But and potentially, though, that does free up a little bit of bandwidth for our higher frame rate. So as we've said, you know, resolution isn't the top of the list. So sports at a higher frame rate, even if it's only in 1080, but with HDR, could look amazing.
Yeah, because it
So
did have HLG, didn't it,
yeah, it
on
did.
iPlayer?
Yeah.
I mean, Neil, you're at the cutting edge of this stuff. You obviously, you know, the wide client base that you have to be on the ball. You have to be looking at new things. So, are we right? Is this where things are heading? Is HFR and so on going to be the next big thing in displays?
Well, I mean, for me, of course it is. You know, that was one of the main things of HDMI 2.1 when it came in, was to enable those much higher bandwidths and all that type of stuff. It's also, incidentally, a reason why we've tried to segment in our own business the differences between these spaces, because you do make different choices. HFR in a DCI context, for example, would be a multiple of 24, 48, maybe 96. Okay, it doesn't go beyond that at this minute in time because of the immense file size complexities that you would get into by doing that. And of course, remember, that's the source of the movie content that's going to come down the track. You've got to remember that. A movie for a you know, 10,000 nit curve, yeah, the HDR spec for DCI is 300 nits. Okay, it's just a completely different thing altogether. Where does this regrade take place? Because that's what's going to have to happen. And maybe that's a good thing, actually, that that does happen, because, you know, it won't just be a pass through. It'll be redone, and maybe the sound gets remixed in a better way, or whatever else happens. But it's also where we're really starting to see the differences that you can apply to your designs. Because if you are really interested in 120, we have people who are interested in gaming. Okay, simulators, right? There's a big one. You boys will know this as well, right? 240 frames per second they're looking for, because that can be the difference between, you know, 240 frames per second. You can hardly even imagine the amount of data that's getting pushed in those situations. But that technology just pulls away now. So that's where it becomes very exciting as a designer, because you can look at what is the actual content that's going to be used in the context of this space, and you can optimize that whole system around that. I mean, 240 frames per second, if someone says that they want that, you better make sure there ain't no lag in that system, for example. On the flip side, if the client is saying, you know what, this is for me a space where I'll have the lights on, but I am interested in, you know, your display that you've said that's 21 by 9. You probably can accept to put video processing in there that might have 200 milliseconds of delay. But if that then does so many more things that are better, that's a perfectly valid, you know, trade-off that you're making. And I think that for me is what's more exciting. And I jumped in. I'm sure Jules was going to make the point about the no 4K feeds at the Euros, but for me that was so interesting that they had made a very definitive choice. And of course, there's lots of different reasons why they did that. It was like, you just ain't going to see it. You just ain't going to see the benefit of that in the context of fast moving sports. Much better to use our bandwidth for other things. It's just a much different way of thinking about things. And internet, of course, look, we're all sitting at home streaming. Well, you know, I've got a gigabit connection. I'm sure you guys are all the same, because, you know, why not these days? You know what, mine still stutters every so often or whatever else. It still has that moment when it starts and then it gets better. There's just a certain amount of resolution that you trade off because of that. So just think it's a very interesting time for all of these different technologies.
Jules, in terms of video processing, it's not something I've kept in the loop, and I know Neil has it as well. But you know, for me, back in the day when we had Barco projectors and so on, you know, CRTs, and you had to have video processing, off-board video processor. We're getting to the stage now where certainly in the TV world, I see absolutely no need for an external video processor whatsoever in terms of, you know, calibration, in terms of, you know, signal input, in terms of resolution and so on. Is it still the case that a video processor is needed when it comes to projection systems and what you're doing in clients' rooms?
I would say so. I mean, I think that Obviously, it depends on the projector and the level of projector you're looking at, the amount of processing power that's in that projector. But just as it's always been a good idea to have a separate AV processor, so it's also a good idea to have a separate video processor as well. Doesn't mean you're going to get a bad experience from what's natively in that projector, but you can do more with more processing power. And as you mentioned, the calibration side of it, these video processors that are available, we all know the brands, work in the same way. We're outputting sending an SDR signal to the display. We're packaging HDR within an SDR container, and we can do LUTs, which I can't do directly into the projector. None of the projectors that we can deal with, and like but even if you're talking about an LG G4 or something like that, we're doing a matrix LUT there. It's not a proper full, 2, 4,000, whatever, 13, 17 cubed LUT that goes into those when you're doing those TVs. So I think you can get better, more accurate color using a video processor into HDR than you can do otherwise. And if we're then talking different aspect ratios, you absolutely have to have, if you're, 21, if you're doing, a 2.4 to 1 screen or any other dimension, you actually have to have unless you've got 1.78 to 1, and then you have to accept the black bars. You have to absolutely have a video processor. So I think for projection, it's still very, very desirable to have one. Though, that doesn't mean you're going to get a terrible experience without one, if you know what I mean. So.
And what kind of range of projector are we talking about there? Because Neil, you deal all the way up to many hundreds of thousands of
So
pounds
does
in
Julian
terms.
these days
Yeah,
nowadays, yeah.
yeah, yeah. So even at that price point, is a standalone processor still a requirement there?
But you know what? It's funny. In fact, it's not so much when you go up, because if you look at what a video processor adds, it's power. Just what Joel said there. Okay. They have so much incredible processing power, and we've been talking about these high frame rates. Remember, they're doing all of these billions of pixels every second. You just need to have immense processing power to do better than what's built into the TVs, which are already immense compared to what we had 5 or 10 years ago. We all know the story about how powerful our phones are and all that type of thing. There's kind of two things that we've seen, right? And I don't think it's right to say about the value of the projector. I have to tell you, I won't mention a brand, but I got a press release about a new projector that came out that was £1,200 retail, and I shared it with my colleagues because I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what was included in this projector for such a low price. Okay, I bet a lot of money that projector would look way better with a video processor in front of it. Okay, a common discussion that we have is, are you better to take the mid-level projector and the video processor, or the top level projector? Spends the same. What's the best overall result in that whole thing? So in fact, we've not really found that it's like there's no point where the value is too high to put a video processor. In fact, it only gets more obvious how much benefit, to be honest, you get. It's where do you actually say to yourself, well, economically, there's no point to do it. And I mean, the projectors at £1,000 from Epson and various other brands are so good now. Actually can still bring a lot more performance out of those things with a video processor. So it's still very, very interesting to do that. Now, if I could just pick up one other point, of course, we're all talking about quality, right? If there's one thing that I have noticed over the years of adding a video processor, it's a very intangible thing. It just makes things easier, right? The experience of the user is a lot better normally. And I wish, Joe's, I'm sure you're the same. How could we put a number against that? 95 out of 100 usability experience, because people would pay a lot of money for that type of thing. But that actually is one of the main things that you find. If you talk about aspect ratio control, the video processors, I think both of them can do this now. The two main players can detect the content aspect, and then that can be fed out to control a masking system, for example. That's a typical one I'm sure everyone understands that we see every single day. Well, if you try to explain to someone who's not a total enthusiast, look, when you see that black bar, you've got to press this button on your remote control, and torture. If you can just say, "Don't worry, sir, it'll all happen as if by magic," that's a different user experience altogether. Okay, so that it's not just about the performance visually that's brought to the table, it's the performance from an end user perspective that's brought to the table that still almost always justifies a video processor and a projection system. And look, still a lot of the time in a even a very high end display system, they'll make everything look better.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time yet again. It's caught up on us. But as you can tell, we haven't come to a conclusion, because I don't think there is a conclusion. I think it comes down to the individual. It comes down to the room. We're back to where we were at square one. But hopefully, we've given you some options to think about. Hopefully, the discussion has maybe highlighted something that you didn't know existed. Maybe we've kind of cemented in your head your idea was good and you should follow that. And if you've got any questions, you can ask them. Go onto AV Forums. We have a whole section about home cinema design and members who have designed their own cinemas, and there's also professional cinema builds and all that kind of thing. Go get some inspiration. Go have a look. Go see what floats your boat. What is it that you're looking for at the end of the day, and you know, what display is going to fit with that? So when it comes to the question, TV or projector, and is it an easy choice to make? I'm going to sit on the fence, because I don't think it is an easy choice to make. I think it's very much user case dependent. Steve, what do you think?
I echo your thoughts on that one. Yeah,
I think there's going to be a lot of dependent. There's going to be a lot of fence sitting here. Jules,
TV or projector? For me personally, if the room is right, projector. If I'm in a living room, probably a TV, but
another fence sitter.
Yeah.
And Neil.
See, I'm not even going to sit on the fence. I just need two rooms, because I need and I need one for the flat panel.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because that's the difference. They're so different now.
Yeah.
And in fact, both of them offer a wonderful experience, but it's a different experience, and I want both of them because I'm greedy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, it is. It's a different experience. And you need to find out which one it is that you want to go for, because that will then dictate how you're going to use your space, how you're going to use your audio system.
Yeah.
It's something that we've discussed in the past. You know, where do you put a center speaker when you've got a micro LED wall? But, you know, these are things that once you know what you want, and Neil said this right at the start, what is the screen size? What's the room like? What's going to work? And then work from that point. And hopefully that answers the question that we set at the beginning of our clickbait title for this podcast. But there you go. Hopefully we've come up with something at the end there. But time really is running against us. So we quickly need to do competitions and supporters. So over to you, Jules.
Yes, you can win a single Oslo home cinema seat worth £1,400 courtesy of Valencia Theatre Seating. It features Italian top grain Nappa leather, a powered headrest and lumbar adjustments, hidden arm storage and LED lighting. Closing date is 11:59 p.m. Friday, 31st of August, 2024. You can also win £500 to spend with MPB. MPB is the largest global platform to buy, sell and trade in used photo and video gear. Again, closing date, 11:59 p.m. Friday, 31st of August, 2024. And you can win a streaming system worth £2,400, which includes a Roxen Atessa integrated streaming amp and the Monitor Audio Silver 100 7G bookshelf speakers. Once again, closing date, 11:59 p.m. Wednesday, August the 28th.
Yep, all competitions are open to eligible AV Forums members over 18 and resident in the UK. So basically everybody apart from me. So head over to avforums.com/competitions to enter. There's also disc competitions over there as well. So if you want to win DVDs, Blu-rays, 4K discs, all that kind of thing, there's lots and lots of competitions there available for our patrons. And of course, standard AV Forums members can win those as well. And again, the same thing applies AV Forums members, patrons, resident in the UK. Got some previous winners, Jules.
Yes, Stevio 67 won the Denon AVR X 1800H AVR worth £699, courtesy of Peter Tyson. BHX TC won a pair of Q-Acoustics M40 powered micro tower speakers and QED digital cables worth £1,069. And Badger Studer won a copy of Chinatown on 50th Anniversary Collector's Edition 4K Ultra HD worth £40.
And we got some new patrons.
Yes, we've got Bruce Wood and Mark Thatcher. I had to read that very carefully.
And also bought us a coffee.
Yes, this is a weird one. T brought us three coffees.
Well, I don't drink coffee, so you guys can have those three. Yeah, well, thank you very much to our participants this week. Thank you guys. It really is appreciated you coming and giving us your knowledge and your experiences, and hopefully our members get something from that. So thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
And
Thank you,
our
Phil.
next
Thanks.
episode is the movies and TV show with Kaz and the team. That's on Monday the 26th of August, followed by the 4K and Blu-ray disc physical media show on Thursday the 29th. And that's getting great traffic. It's nice to see that physical media is still appreciated and you guys love your disc collections. So yeah, join Kaz and the team for that. Those will be 7 p.m. on the podcast channel and also the audio only versions on iTunes and Spotify and so on. And that's it for us. Don't forget you can buy us a coffee if you like it, buymeacoffee.com/AVForums. You can become a patron. You'll find the links below or next to this podcast. And I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening. Don't forget the room build is starting very soon. We'll cover that in the next podcast and look out for the thread in the home cinema builds. But we'll see you again very soon. Goodbye.